Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up. But first, a few thoughts of my own, and that's where this cap comes in. This cap, which is quite a nice cap, it's sort of got a plaid in it. You'd think it was made in Ireland or England. It, in fact, was made, it says it was designed in the USA, but if you look up here, it says it was made in China. I do wonder how much design there is in a cap. They've been around for quite a while. The only difference I can make is it's a piece of plastic where there used to be a piece of canvas years ago. But it's not really a joke. Not everything manufactured in China is something to joke about. And that's going to be the subject of our program today. Particularly, we're concerned, or we are looking at concerns about the South China Sea and the claims there by China, built, backed up by a vigorous construction program on some reefs and atolls. We're going to be looking at that. It is a large headache for the administration and a very much bigger headache for neighboring countries like Vietnam. Linda, would you like to introduce our guests?
I would, Llewellyn. Our first guest today is Sean Hensler. He is professor at the United States Naval War College, College of Operational and Strategic Leadership. Welcome to the program, Sean.
Thank you.
And our second guest is an old friend, Jim Lutis. He is director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University.
I'd like to begin by asking you to give us a little brief explanation of the situation in the South China Sea. And I might say there's an excellent, excellent report from the Boston Global Forum in Boston, obviously. On the South China Sea. I think you've seen that. You may even have contributed to it. How do you see the situation? What is happening?
Well, what is happening lately is that the United States recently conducted what's called a Freedom of Navigation operation in the South China Sea to assert our rights of freedom of navigation. But it goes much beyond the events of the last week. And if I don't know how we could go very far back, but maybe I could take you as far back as May of this year when our Secretary of Defense took a good hard look at the significant land reclamation that you mentioned. The Chinese have built up seven different, I'll call them landforms for the moment. Some people refer to them as artificial islands, but there's actually a significance to that. But a massive land reclamation on seven different disputed areas in the South China Sea to the extent that they actually have harbors, an airstrip on one, radars and other such things. It became such a concern, the Secretary of Defense asked the Department of Defense for options to potentially conduct what's called a Freedom of Navigation operation because the Chinese have...
And I might say that's an expression we're going to hear. The acronym is FONOPS, and we're going to hear a lot about FONOPS in the months ahead.
That's correct. I mean, FONOPS is the term. It stands for Freedom of Navigation Operation. And what the Secretary was really asking was, what, if anything, could we or should we do to assert our rights? The United States considers it a vital interest, a vital national interest to assert freedom of navigation, not just in the South China Sea, but around the globe.
Jim, the South China Sea has been claimed by China since the late 1940s. And there's a thing called the nine-dash line, which actually basically takes in the whole of the South China Sea. Are we seeing here something unique in international territorial claims where a country is trying to steal a whole ocean?
I don't know that that is as interesting as what Sean described as this reclamation projects where they're essentially taking shoals and rocks that that historically have not emerged above the waves, even at low tide, landforms they're essentially trying to change the facts on the ground for a variety of both operational and international legal reasons.
One third of the world's shipping passes through there.
$5 trillion in trade each year.
And what do you think the Chinese purpose is here?
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, and that is this nine-dash line, as it's referred to, or the cow's tongue, people hear it referred to because it almost looks like the shape of a cow's tongue. It originated really back in the 1940s before the communist government took over. And It originally was a 12-dash line, then 11, then 10. It's kind of gone back and forth
That's
over
right.
time.
I believe it was originally drawn in 1936.
Yeah, I believe it was. And there's research has indicated that there was a water department when the nationalist government was in place that drew it originally. But it was adopted when the communist government took over, and it has been there in various forms ever since. But only recently, and I would argue in 2009, the Chinese issued a note verbal to the UN and essentially said, we have sovereignty over the entire South China Sea, the landforms, the water, as well as the subsoil. And so the world has been kind of coming to grips with what does that really mean, that this ambiguous claim, what does it really mean?
Yeah. Sean, the United States sending the USS Larsen to into the waters near Subi Reef, which is one of these artificial, it's a destroyer. It's a destroyer, and it is not only that, but it has guided missiles on it. And the fact that we sent the Larsen there, China has called this a deliberate provocation. And it seems to me that China, with these artificial islands, has got a game plan. The game plan could be, as I outline it, to limit America's military options. Number two, to give it leverage over the key trade routes. And number three, to make America, look a little hapless in order to strengthen its clout with its neighbors. So China has a game plan with the islands. What is our game plan?
That's a good question. And I've argued before, I'm not 100% sure that we have a cohesive, synchronized game plan with respect to China at this point in time. So the USS Larsen did sail through, but as you may recall, that was only after months of debate at the highest levels. I can tell you that open press is indicating that the United States military is pushing for this sooner rather than later, but potentially folks in the administration and in the State Department were more reluctant for various reasons. So it's probably the context of this larger conversation. What is the game plan? I think in the near term, it's to assert our right of freedom of navigation in the South China Sea.
Jim, there are actual islands as well as these right. built-up landforms or whatever euphemism for rocks under the water is. There's two archipelagos, the Spratly and the Paracel. Who claims those besides China? All of those countries have some territorial claim right. to some of the islands.
Right, so the Philippines have claims, Vietnam has claims, China certainly has claims.
Malaysia, Brunei,
Taiwan.
Yeah. All of the literal nations along the South China Sea, this has been a growing concern for a long time. This is not just something that popped in the last week, right? The question about what U.S. policy is in the region, I think, is a really valid one. We have not seen any sort of clear statement of U.S. policy. We've seen a real desire to stay out of the territorial disputes. And there have been a lot of critics in the region who have specifically been concerned that this lack of engagement by the United States was essentially giving China a free hand. And so not just has the U.S. military been saying we need to do this sort of operation, our allies have been looking for us to be more assertive. And the danger has been that if we are not more assertive, those in Japan and elsewhere will find reason to be more assertive on their own.
How would you say more assertive? They're not going to go to war with China, are they?
I think that the question is: would anybody feel a need to be more assertive, more muscular, for whether national domestic reasons or domestic political reasons? You could have a war of miscalculation, certainly.
If I could add to that,
yes.
Both in the open press, Australia has indicated that the military planners are actually planning for the possibility of a freedom navigation operation, this being the Australian military, and Japan has indicated that they're potentially considering something along those lines as well. And I would add that the United States has encouraged other nations to assert rights of freedom of navigation in the area, and so I agree with what you said, uh-huh. The possibility for miscalculation is something.
It's not just the South China Sea. Japan is interested in claims that China has in the East China Sea.
Right.
Somebody once said to me that one of the unfortunate things in Asia is that oceans are named after countries, and then they think they own them.
Yeah. Well, and you know, in 2011, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a bit of a gaffe when she referred to the South China Sea as the West Philippine Sea.
Right, exactly.
And that could have caused quite a diplomatic kerfluffle if it had gotten more attention.
Let me ask you, in your research, what do you think the long game for China is?
Well, I think this is it's an interesting question for a number of reasons, but foremost, it could be a huge historical one, which is that China was a continental power for so many centuries. It is now at a point through its economic prosperity that it can become a maritime power. What it does with that maritime power, I think, is still unfolding in China. Would you agree with that,
I think,
Sean?
That's exactly the question. You know, China is clearly a rising power, both economically and militarily. And it has been historically, as you, I think, rightly point out, a land-centric. But in terms of its maritime now, it has a blue water navy, legitimately. It has vessels that are patrolling off the Horn of Africa, anti-piracy missions. There's talk of a base in Djibouti. They patrol in the Indian Ocean. They've patrolled in the Aleutians. They have vessels coming for the first time ever to Mayport, Florida, to visit the East Coast here next week. And so how they choose to use that power is really the question that people are really asking.
And I think the thing is that we're operating on this post-World War II model. Our post-World War II model said freedom of navigation, peaceful settlement of disputes, and also fidelity of contracts. China is trying to actually put their own stamp on things. What their stamp on that is going to be, as I said, is still unfolding. But certainly to us, when we look at China building another aircraft carrier, when we look at their Coast Guard building what is called the monster cutter, it says to us that they're militarizing. How do we tamp this down? And I think that we've had some exchanges between our Navy and between the Chinese Navy recently that would say we're trying to cool this off.
I think you tamp this down is an interesting word, but we've had significant military-to-military contacts with the Chinese Navy in particular over the last several years. Our CNO just had a VTC, our Chief of Naval Operations, just held a VTC video teleconference with the head of the Chinese Navy this week. Admiral Harris, our Pacific Commander and PAC Fleet Commanders are going to be visiting there in the near future. We've hosted them here in the United States. And so we've negotiated agreements with respect to unplanned encounters at sea and in the air to try to keep that risk of miscalculation. So if that's
that
what you're referring
acronym.
To.
That has
Q's.
An acronym. Q's. We're going to hear a lot about that.
Yeah, so there's a code of conduct for unplanned encounters at sea, but there's also a DOD negotiated document, both air and surface as well. But so those are the types of things that we're trying to do to prevent miscalculation. And we can talk about the Black Sea bumping incidents or other incidents where miscalculation has happened. But writ large, I think there's a recognition that China is going to be a growing power. And what's the relationship that you have with that major power? Yeah. I think that's really the question.
And another question is, what is the U.S. strategic interest in that region? It would seem it is huge, but I'm going to ask you to wait a second for station identification. Primarily for our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, channel 124, the POTUS channel, you are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello of this program, and today our distinguished guest, Sean Hensler, professor of the United States Naval War College, College of Operational and Strategic Leadership, and he points out he appears as an individual today, not as a representative of the War College.
Thank you, correct.
Is that correct? And this program, of course, can be seen on 200 American television screens and around the world on the English language stations of the Voice of America. Our last guest is Jim Ludus, director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy, at Salve Regina University. And you worked with our current Secretary of State when he was a senator, Senator Kerry?
I did.
What do you think his reaction in this situation, knowing him, is likely to be?
Well, I think his personal reaction will be one very balanced, very serious, very sober. But there's something that Linda raised that I'd like to come back to. It's this idea of what is China's intention here? What are they trying to build? And what can the United States do to try to shift that outcome? One of the things that has been intriguing to me since the Lassen made its transit was the reaction in both the official and in the quasi-official media in China. There was no unanimous condemnation. There was no unanimous desire for a greater confrontation with the United States. Nobody liked the fact that the United States had sent a destroyer through these waters. But there was room for debate about what the Chinese response should be. And the fact that even in those official and quasi-official channels, there was some difference of opinion about next steps, I think suggests that there is probably still some latitude for maneuver in China, and that leaves room for maneuver in the relationship with the United States. As to what Secretary Kerry is probably thinking at this point, I haven't spoken to him about this, and I haven't really seen him in a couple of years. He's been a little busy, so I certainly don't want to speak out of turn. But my guess would be is that he would be concerned. I'm sure that he was consulted in terms of the freedom of navigation operation, and I think that he probably approached this with a type of resolve, but also mindful of the other priorities in the U.S.-China relationship.
David Sanger of the New York Times at the Boston Global Forum recently talked about this issue, and he said that it was terribly important that we sign and ratify the new Pacific Trade Agreement, which is having a fairly hard time. Democrats don't love it, and Republicans don't love anything too much at the moment. How important is that?
I think I would defer to you on that.
I think that it is the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a long negotiated trade deal, which would basically lock the United States into trade arrangements with nations all across the Pacific.
It doesn't include China, but
it does show these other countries, Vietnam, etc., that we care.
It doesn't currently include China. It leaves open the possibility for ultimately, if China agrees to certain behaviors and certain standards of operation, then they could become a party to it. But I think that in the context of presidential politics, moving free trade through the United States Senate, even with fast track authority, seems to be it's going to be a hard sell.
I think that going back to the Boston Global Forum report that was issued in October, I think it's some of the recommendations of the report are really important. I think number one, ratify the law of the sea. That is really important.
Yeah,
that's
we haven't talked US about the law
UN
of the
convention
sea.
Of the law of the sea.
We have a tendency of sign international treaties and not ratify.
That's right.
China has actually ratified it. It ratified it in 1996.
Indeed it did. Number two is joint development of the natural resources. The big battle that I can see around here is the fact that there is oil and gas proven reserves around the Spratly Islands and the Paracels. And I think that China wants to make sure that they are not excluded from the benefits, from the economic benefits of that joint development. Joint development would go a long way to assuring that. And number three is establishing this Pacific Security Alliance. Now, that sounds a lot like a NATO, but at the same point, it would allow joint patrols that China would be able to also participate on. Just from those recommendations, Sean, what sounds like it's doable?
Well, the UNCLOS thing does not sound doable. And I say that because we the United States, presidents, secretaries of defense, secretaries of the Navy, CNOs have argued for years we ought to sign it. And for various reasons throughout its sordid history, we've not ratified it. So I don't know that anybody's going to be willing to spend their political capital at the moment or has it, although the time might be ripe to do so. And I've made that argument myself, but I'm not optimistic. With respect to the the Pacific Security Alliance, which I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, China recently, at a recent conference, asked other nations in the area to join in on joint patrols in the South China Sea with them. So the United States is, we do exercises at times with others in the area. So there may be some room there, possibly. It's going to be interesting. And then your last point about, I'm sorry, your third point.
The development of the oil and gas resources, the joint development of those.
Here's why I'll turn over. But if some viewers might be unaware that the Philippines actually has a case against China at The Hague, at the Permanent Court of Arbitration. And just this week, the court ruled that it has jurisdiction over the case. Now, the Chinese, what does that really mean in legal speak? The Philippines essentially is saying they want the court to make some type of ruling on who has the economic, you know, control over the economic resources in this region, because there's oil, natural gas, and fishing is huge.
Absolutely,
in this area as well.
Huge.
So this court is going to make a ruling probably within the next year. And how the Chinese react to that ruling, up till now they haven't participated officially. They refuse to accept jurisdiction of the court, despite the fact, as you noticed, they have signatories to UNCLOS. And so this how the court rules and how China reacts to it is going to be a very significant indication on whether or not they're willing to live up to international rules, standards, and norms.
The law of the sea, which is the only real document you can refer to, is the only legal basis. Under that, what are these islands and rocks under the close to the surface?
So that's a great point.
Are they ocean commons? Are they regarded as commons, as the oceans themselves are generally regarded as international commons?
I can speak to at least the law is very, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is very specific. So to make it simple, if something is an island, which means it's above water at high tide, it's habitable and can sustain some type of economic activity, then it's entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea in a 200 mile exclusive economic zone. And the airspace above the territorial sea is national airspace. Arguably, none of the seven landforms that we're talking about here are islands. Now, there are things called rocks. Arguably, three or four of these, what are now artificial islands, prior to the building, were rocks. A rock is above water at high tide, but can't sustain life or economic
activity.
Give
us the names of some of those rocks.
So there's the geologists and folks between Subi Reef, Fiery Cross Reef, the various different reefs.
Mischief Reef.
It's argued that four were low tide elevations. A low tide elevation is entitled to no territorial sea, no airspace. You can fly over it, steam by it. These rocks, though, do get a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. The question is, whose rock is it? And if it's nobody's rock specifically, does it, or many have argued it doesn't have any territorial sea or airspace because nobody officially has it yet. So interestingly enough, the last thing that went through, some reports said it went through an innocent passage. I don't think that's what it did, because we picked a reef that was a low tide elevation prior to the land reclamation. Therefore, it's entitled to no national airspace, no territorial seas. So we didn't go through an innocent passage. We just went through in high seas, you know, exercising high seas freedoms. But I will say, and I'll turn it over to you, the White House put the clamps on folks from talking about exactly what we did, to the point where Secretary of Defense Carter was in front of Congress. They were asking him, did we just sail the last one through? Did we just sail the last one through? And he couldn't answer. And so I think that the strategic communications piece should have backed up what we did. Instead, it's still kind of unclear. Naval officers think we should have flown helicopters and done everything to ensure that we made clear it was not an innocent passage.
Yeah, and you know, the Chinese this week, at least open source reports indicate, flew a couple of fighter jets armed, bristling with missiles through the region after the last, and actually in the last couple of days, just to sort of prove the point that, you know, this is, they can operate in this space as well. The lack of strategic communication on this issue is a real problem, and it's been a problem in this entire administration. It's a failure to communicate clearly U.S. intentions. If I wanted to be sympathetic, I would describe it as a form of pragmatism. But I think this is a case where there are longstanding U.S. interests and values at stake, and the U.S. response has been pretty quiet heretofore.
Let's move from the immediate issue of the rocks in the South China Sea to the larger matter of relations with China, which depends very heavily on us for trade. We're a very huge trading partner, and the rest of the democratic world. Likewise, there was a rather funny case in Europe where when they tried to impose sanctions on for dumping, I think, on Jonah for women's bras. There were not enough bras to go around, and Peter Mandelson, who was the EU Trade Commissioner, had to back down. The women of Europe wanted their underwear. They did not care about the international importance of it. They simply wanted, and they wouldn't, so to speak.
I can attest they can get them from Sri Lanka.
But I wonder whether these issues get settled on that issue or not on something else. And that gets to be a side settlement of some bigger issue. When we, for example, you know, some of the relationships we had with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War was surprisingly give and take on other issues. What do you think about that?
There's certainly plenty of history to support that as a model. You know, there was also a lot of press in the last couple of weeks about the Chinese president's visit to the United Kingdom and the trade relationship that seems to be growing. And is England China's best friend in Europe? And what does that mean for the special relationship with the United States?
Well, I thought a lot of that was silly.
Well, I agree. And the relationship with England goes back in a very sad way with China, including the mid-19th century opium wars, which China has never, I believe, actually gotten over. Because in 1842, or three, I think, when the Treaty of Nanking was signed, China lost Hong Kong to England, and it was going to be in perpetuity. There were also ports that China had to allow British ships to enter as favored ships. China's identity now, I think, is very much, you know, I'm not saying that this is payback, but a lot of the way it feels about the West, a lot of the reason why it feels it needs to protect the South China Sea is because that was the typical area of invasion for Western countries. It was through the South China Sea. And so therefore, in this century, China wants to say, all right, we're going to put our mark on this. It's no more England, no more France, no more the United States. We are going to write this history. And the way they write it, I think, is going to be the most important thing.
I think you may have something there, but how we respond to their writing of it.
Absolutely.
And how we look after our friends like Vietnam. I wonder, Linda, in our last few minutes, if you would say something about the Boston Global Forum, which has so informed this program.
It's an interesting group of people who have gotten together, who have decided that Asia is an important place to place its focus, especially relationships between countries.
But it involves a lot of professors from Harvard, MIT,
From
Northwestern, and is
Governor Michael Dukakis, for instance,
who is the titular head of it all.
Absolutely is involved with it. And it is this idea that we need to understand our relationship. We need to make sure that it gets a good start. And we have the opportunity at this turn of the century to make a good start.
It's a young think tank.
It's a young think tank.
Thinking about the South China Sea and about cyber security. That is our program for today. We're so glad you came along. And please come back next week when we will be back on the same stations at the same time. Until then, from myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello, Sean Hensler, and Jim Ludis, good day.